Now, I'm Mr. Fishman. I normally give the next semester of this course, the culture or European cultural history, 1870. It's supposed to be to the present, but it goes instead to 1945. And this one, I gather, is advertised as 1815 to 1870. But clearly, if I'm talking about Rousseau today, it starts much earlier. And I gather Professor Mossi has chosen this year to start with Pascal. He told me that the thing he'd like me to discuss, and this is something I really enjoy discussing, is Rousseau and this notion of the autonomous man, this notion which becomes so much a part of the 18th century. Now, the place where I'd like to begin is really with a book that came out about 25 years ago, however, a book that has very little to do with Rousseau directly and only has to do with this notion of something we might call the autonomous man. This is a book published by David Riesman called The Lonely Crowd. It's not any longer a very popular book. Some of you may be familiar with it. In the book, what Riesman does is to discuss American society and what he perceives to be one of the great changes that has occurred in American society. That change, as he describes it, is from the inner-directed personality, as he coins the term, to an other-directed personality. It's a very simple set of concepts, really. The inner-directed personality, says Riesman, was someone whom we might associate with the 19th century American past, the rural past of America, as opposed to the urban 20th century. The person who grew up primarily in a rural society, primarily in a family, rather than with his or her peers, that such a person grew up rather inner-directed, with the whole set of values that person had, with almost all of the choices that person had, sort of coming from an inner gyroscope, moral gyroscope, if you will. And it was the kinds of decisions that a person made were implanted really by the family, by growing up perhaps on a farm, somewhat isolated, as part of a church-going community, quite different from the kind of urban setting in which most of you and most people grow up today. People who grew up in that kind of 19th century past, or who grew up even in this century in a kind of rural setting of that nature, these people, as I said, had a kind of notion of what's right and wrong without referring always to other people. I think you can see where I'm going here. I'm describing what might be called a kind of an autonomous personality, a person who knew just by his upbringing or her upbringing what was right or wrong and didn't pick up all the cues from other people. What's happened today, according to Riesman, what's happened in the mid-20th century in America, is that everyone grows up with their peer groups. You're segregated, you're structured into peer groups, you grow up and you matriculate along with your peer group through school, you matriculate along all the way, even now, with people almost entirely the same age. Where do you get your values? How do you decide what's right and wrong, what to wear, almost anything? Well, you decide by picking up almost all your cues from your peers. You're other-directed, says Riesman. You're other-directed. I use this as just a kind of analogy because it'll give you some idea of, I think, what Rousseau was striving for when he wrote Émile back in the 18th century. He was striving to create an Émile, a new person, who would be inner-directed. At least that's what he says that he's striving to do. We'll examine whether he achieves that or not in a few moments. But he wants to create a kind of inner-directed person. And I use this modern kind of setting, this modern context, I think, to give you an idea, at least, of what a semblance of what he was trying to do. The inner-directed Émile would be someone who knew what to do, right and wrong, in almost every circumstance, and would not be someone who would have to go off and ask anybody, because he would have grown up in touch with his true and genuine self. Now, the inner-directed person, as Riesman describes an inner-directed person, probably wouldn't be concerned so much with his genuine self as perhaps what he had been taught in church or in the family or somewhere along the way, that this kind of inner gyroscope of value that determined values would have been there then. This is not exactly what Rousseau had in mind. So I'll leave Riesman. I just wanted to use this as a kind of, as I say, a context to give this some meaning. What Rousseau, of course, has in mind with Émile is something different. I gather you're all in the process of reading Émile now. But first, let me talk about Rousseau, the person. Rousseau, this rather strange figure who looms as such an important figure in the 18th century, and yet a figure that no one really knows what to do with. You know, when you deal with Rousseau, how do you begin? I think one of the places to begin is to, at least for me it's always important, is to try and put the so-called great figure in history in some perspective. Now, how great are great people? You know, is the history of ideas, is cultural history, a kind of catalog of great thinkers? Do you go from, Locke to Montesquieu to Rousseau, and, you know, along the way? Is that what it is, like a double play combination in baseball or something? You know, is it supposed to be that way? Well, let me debunk the great. First, let me start by debunking the idea that any great figure exercised such a singular and profound influence. And then perhaps I'll go the opposite direction and really tell you how important Rousseau was. I think so often we tend to seize upon a single figure, whether it's Freud in the early 20th century, late 19th and early 20th century, Rousseau, or wherever, we tend to seize upon a figure and make this figure almost larger than life. I don't know what that satisfies in us, but I think we tend to make them more important probably than they were. What usually these figures really do, what usually these figures who stand out in the story of the history of ideas really have done, is take some idea, state it forcefully, perhaps state it better than almost anyone else has stated it, but state it at a time when many people probably are beginning to believe that idea to be true already. And they work it out. I think one of the things that makes someone like Rousseau, or I use the analogy of someone like Freud, so important is that, for one thing, they're so cocksure they're right. That's one thing. They're absolutely convinced that they're right. And that conviction carries with it a tremendous power for people who read what they write. The other thing is that they are very much with their times. They're not really that far ahead of them. You know, old Hegel's idea of the great intellectual figure is someone who kind of sees ahead, is a kind of seer who sees the way God's mind is working out into the future, and sort of works out into the future. I don't think that's the way it works with someone like Rousseau. I think he was saying, as we'll see, what so many people actually were beginning to believe at the time, and when they began to read Rousseau and to hear about Rousseau, they said, you know, people would say, that's exactly what I was thinking, but he just says it so much better. That he articulates something very forcefully. Usually the prose is also important as well. Freud was a great writer of German prose. Rousseau was a great writer of French prose. And to read Rousseau is to be carried along also by the force of the language. If you read Emile carefully, you'll realize, and I'll get to that in a moment too, you'll realize that there are an enormous number of contradictions in this. That didn't bother him. It was the power of, you know, you have to almost read it impressionistically. You have to almost read what he's writing impressionistically, because you have to get the overall impression. It doesn't fit into some careful logical scheme, because it quite often does come back on itself. Some of the prose comes, turns around and contradicts what has been said two or three pages earlier. So I think you have to read it with a certain eye to that, but also to see that the importance of Rousseau is lies a good deal in the fact that he was saying what so many people at the time were beginning to believe. The kinds of people who were beginning to believe it, of course, were often the intellectuals of the day. But these are the people who then made a kind of cult of Rousseau. A kind of Rousseau-mania developed. You know, it got down eventually to almost every level. We have the stories of Marie Antoinette thinking, in fact, that it would be very health-giving to play like a shepherdess, and then having, you know, she kind of lost the spirit of Rousseau in the notion of it. She didn't want to go out into the forest where it was messy, but had, you know, a herd of sheep brought into the gardens of Versailles, so she could go 1 hour each day down there and pretend like she was a shepherdess, and that would somehow be health-giving and giving her genuine self in some way. We find this sort of thing. It got into a kind of cult of Rousseau that went, through many levels of society. Those people who read Rousseau carefully were really also quite taken with him. Their stories, wonderful stories, probably told about a lot of figures, of Kant, the great philosopher, out in far distant Königsberg in East Prussia, who we're told, you know, never missed a day of class at the University of Königsberg, and was the person by whom people set their timepieces, whatever they had, adjusted their hourglasses when he walked by because he was so prompt all the time. The day he picked up a meal, we're told, what happened? He never got to class at all. He was so taken with it. It's probably the same story told about a lot of other people. But anyway, apocryphal or not, this is the kind of effect Rousseau was supposed to have had. Now, as I say, I'm deprecating genius a bit. On the other hand, I don't think one can deny that this man did have an ability to move people and to carry him, as I said, even with his prose. Even today, one of the nice things about Rousseau, as you read this, is that it sloganizes so nicely. You know, in a world that's always looking for slogans, and we have precious few around, usually the most we have is no smoking or something like that. But in a world, we have some rather paltry ones on the library, I think. We have one up on, where else do we have slogans? We have one up on South Hall, I know. We have one inside the fountain out there. The worst is the one inside the fountain. I've forgotten, I've repressed it. I can't remember it at all. Just look at the slogan sometimes. But if you run a good slogan, you have to look at Rousseau. Even though he died prior to the revolution, you can see he died in 1778. The slogans of Rousseau lived on. In his social contract, he starts with a great line. Man is born free, but is everywhere in chains. Man is born free, but is everywhere in chains. What could be better for a revolutionary banner? And then if you read the social contract, well, it's an entirely different thing. But these slogans are just marvelous. Same thing in Rousseau. How does it start? Children are born, something to the effect that when you're born, you're stuffed into swaddling clothes, and when you die, you're stuffed into a coffin. And it's nothing but that all the way in between, being stuffed into things rather than being a free human being. Well, now, something else about this manner of writing and this manner by which he put this together, Emile and his other works. Rousseau, I think there are two kinds, essentially, and they're probably a spectrum, but there's two kinds of genius, if we want to call it that, and they work in different ways. There's the kind, the romantic genius, of whom Rousseau is the kind of quintessence. The romantic genius is someone who has to express some inner need, writes in a kind of fever pitch, and gets it all out. You know, this is the Beethoven type as well. Beethoven wrote 9 symphonies, and each one was supposed to express some terrible inner need, some turmoil within him. And Beethoven understood it that way. He even describes himself being in touch, you know, with some kind of divine force that no one else appreciated. And then you have the other kind of genius. The other kind of genius who kind of turns out on commission, or, you know, the person who sits down and says, I'm going to write 500 words a day, and does it 365 days a year, 366 in a leap year. And also comes out with something rather remarkable. Mozart is perhaps a better example of that. Mozart, who on his way to Linz forgot he left the symphony back behind that he was commissioned to write for Linz, so he wrote another one. And it's quite a different sort of thing. Therefore, you have Haydn and the 18th century rational type, presumably Haydn, Mozart, even as composers, writing 100 or 40 symphonies, you know, 41 symphonies, quite a different sort of thing than these kind of enormous expressive geniuses. Well, Rousseau fits into this, as I say, this kind of romantic type, which has been with us ever since, that there's some great inner need to express oneself that emerges here. We find it in his own description of his first writing, as a matter of fact, in his autobiography. Let me read that to you. He was, in 1749, on his way to visit his friend Diderot, who was in prison and at Vincennes. It wasn't, you know, these philosophes, these 18th century philosophers, seem to have been frequently in prison for one reason or another, usually for violating censorship laws, and this was the case. Rousseau says he's walking down the road, and he's not too far from Vincennes, and he saw a poster hanging up that advertised, and it was a fairly usual thing to do, a university advertised that there was to be a competition. The competition would be for an essay, and the question raised would be, has the progress of the arts and sciences tended to the purification or to the corruption of morality? Has the progress of the arts and sciences tended to the purification or to the corruption of morality? It's a good kind of question that the French might even still use. If you know what French secondary school students have to write, you know, when they take the baccalaureate degree, the bachot, before you go to a university in France. That's almost exactly the kind of question you'd get. Has the arts and sciences tended to the improvement of the morality of mankind or not, or the improvement, you know, show this? Well, Rousseau describes in his autobiography what this did to him, just seeing this. If anything was ever like a sudden inspiration, it was the impulse. He hadn't written anything up to this point, he tells us. He was 37 years old at the time. If anything was ever like a sudden inspiration, it was the impulse that surged up in me as I read that. Suddenly, I felt my mind dazzled by 1,000 lights. Crowds of lively ideas presented themselves at once with a force and confusion that threw me into an inexpressible trouble. I felt my head seized with a vertigo like that of intoxication. A violent palpitation oppressed me, made me gasp for breath, and being unable any longer to breathe as I walked, it sounds a little extravagant, doesn't it? I let myself drop under one of the trees of the wayside, and there I spent half an hour in such a state of agitation that when I got up, I perceived the whole front of my vest moistened with my own tears, which I had shed unawares. Oh, sir, if ever I could have written even the quarter of what I saw and felt under that tree, with what clarity should I have revealed all the contradictions of the social system? With what force would I have exposed all the abuses of our institutions? In what simple terms would I have demonstrated that man is naturally good and that it is through these institutions alone that men become bad? It was all there, is what he said. All he had to do was go find quill and paper or whatever and put it all down. And that's what he did. And he won the contest. But what he had done was to take the negative. How the arts and sciences have led in some way to the decline of human morality. He took the negative proposition, wrote that, and attacked it as though he were a preacher or this kind of romantic fanatic here, and won the contest. And this started his brilliant writing career following that. So the point here is, though, that he was a particular kind of person, again, perhaps explaining why, as you read Emile, you have to read it almost impressionistically as a man who wrote, as the man who wrote it, probably wrote it in this kind of fever pitch. He didn't sit down and logically work it out sentence by sentence, and it shows it, I think, even in this abridged edition, which is it's a very good abridged edition. If you like this, though, I think you'll even like the unabridged better. It should give you a taste of Rousseau. Well, something about his life, quite briefly. He was born in Geneva, of course, which isn't France, but a Swiss town on the borders of France, independent town, famous for its Calvinist background. We know so much about Rousseau's life because he tells us about it. He wrote really one of the most remarkable autobiographies. Again, something I would strongly recommend to those of you who like autobiographies. It's a marvelous form of literature. It's called The Confessions of Rousseau. It's thick, but it's every bit worth reading. And the thing about it is it also sort of establishes a different kind of autobiography. Someone who really plumbs the depths of his own psyche, tells us things that we would never know without it. Up until this time, the most typical kind of autobiography was the one perhaps that had been started by, the genre of autobiography that had been started by, the Renaissance figure Benvenuto Cellini, which was a kind of advertisement for himself. That says, I am the greatest, something Muhammad Ali might have written several years back. Something that really just wants to hide all the blemishes and tell you how great. It's an assertion of oneself. And even this goes down into the 18th century. We have that great sexual athlete Casanova writing about the same time. I'm the greatest, of a different sort, though. And just listing all of his great conquests and all of the sexual exploits that he engaged in. Then you get to Rousseau. He tells you, in fact, what a miserable creature he was much of the way through this autobiography. He tells you that, in fact, he was probably raised all wrong. That's the implication of it. And Emile would seem to follow from this. If you don't know how to raise people, here's the proper way to do it. And he provides us with Emile in order to give us this kind of advice. But the Confessions tell us that he was raised by his father, his mother having died in childbirth. His father, a kind of ne'er-do-well, petty bourgeois shopkeeper. Well, I guess he was a watchmaker by trade in Geneva. Rousseau tells us from the very beginning his father was a very emotional kind of person, and that the two of them used to sit up nights and read novels. These sentimental novels that, if you look at those early 18th century novels, they're hardly the kind that would cause us to cry today, but apparently caused the two of them to sit up all night and cry as they read them. He had a very rich emotional life as he was brought up. And then, almost as matter-of-factly as he can, he tells you how he left Geneva. He got locked out one day or something at the city gates. He decided to go off on this strange journey. And the novel, or the autobiography in this case, then becomes a kind of picaresque tale of the travels of young Rousseau through France. He goes down to the south of France and there finds an older woman. He calls her Mama. You know, this kind of, we wonder about all of these psychological fixations, his own mother having died early. And he becomes a gigolo, really, a paid gigolo to this woman. He also accepts money. He tells us about this, quite frankly and openly. He also accepts money from some Catholic priests who think they're converting him to Catholicism. He knows he's not being converted, but he accepts their money anyway. He travels about, reads a good deal. Then he takes a job as a tutor, which is very important for our purposes, to little boys. Well, it turns out he's a total failure, he tells us. Again, doesn't try and hide much. In fact, as I say, he tells us things which now, when we try and corroborate them, don't even seem to jive with some of the facts. He may, in fact, even be exaggerating how bad he was in some cases. Well, he said he was a terrible teacher. He didn't have a clue as to what to do. He gave up this job, and with that, he began to read about education. He became really taken with the whole idea of raising someone properly. And as you'll see with Emile, raising someone properly was more than just an education of an individual. It was a way, eventually, of course, to change society, something which we may accept as part of our intellectual baggage, but at the time was bright and new, the idea that you could change society through the proper upbringing of people. Well, where did he go to read? Of course, that person who had the most enormous vogue in France at the time was John Locke, the Englishman who was being translated. And Locke had written about education. Locke had written a good deal about human psychology, and Locke had even rejected out of hand something which had been almost accepted as matter of fact up until the late 17th century, in the beginning of the 18th century, and that is that we're born first with innate ideas. You know, you're born with ideas of good and bad, and furthermore, that we're born innately evil. The good Puritan notion that all people are born bearing original sin. Pascal certainly believed that. Many people in the 18th and the 17th century believed it. What Locke says, and which I'm sure impressed Rousseau enormously, he says this in his book on human psychology, he tells us that people aren't born bad or good. What are they born? They're born neutral, he says. All people are born tabula rasa, like a blank sheet. Tabula rasa, a blank sheet. And how do we come to know things, whether they're good, bad, or anything else, or indifferent? How do we come to know things? Because, and he puts it in big letters, capitals, experience etches that blank sheet, that we're all born with potentialities. Now, he's not a total environmentalist. I don't want to suggest that he's a total environmentalist, as some of you may even be, that everything's determined by the way you're brought up. He doesn't go that far. But he rejects the whole notion of original sin, which to you may seem, you know, so absurd that why should anyone accept it? The idea that we're all born with the sin of Adam and Eve. Well, certainly, whether we accept it or not, in a much more religious age, almost everyone else accepted it. And child rearing was based on the notion that you had to, for example, and once you accept this, break the evil will of a child, expressed in that second year in the terrible twos. Especially when a child becomes assertive, begins to grab and say mine and my and all of those sorts of things, begins to talk, nobody likes those terrible twos. And the notion of child rearing at the time was just to break the will of the child. Whatever he had to do, break the will of the child. We can find any number of letters and child rearing pieces of advice, which almost all say the same thing. Rousseau read, however, Locke, who rejected this. He also read Plato, other people who were considered the great figures of the past on education. Well, now I don't want to go into the entire life of Rousseau, just to say that it wasn't then until 1749, at the age of 37, that he began to write. And in the next dozen years or so, from 1749 to about 1762, he wrote a remarkable series of works. Each one of them, you know, again, I, on one hand, will decry this cult of genius. On the other hand, I'll tell you that each one of these works had a profound influence. So I say, I think that he addressed himself to pertinent subjects at the time. And sometimes it's just his prose, his way of attacking the subject, but also because I think the people who read it really were trying to tackle these subjects themselves. For example, his social contract. He takes the notion of the social contract, very common in political ideas, political thinking at the time, and he puts it together, as I said, with his first sentence being that all men are born free but are everywhere in chains. And then he goes on from there and describes something which even puzzles people today. If you read the social contract, is he talking about a democracy that he would like to see created? Or is he talking about some sort of totalitarian government? Because once, the social contract is something that fits in even with Emile. What he says is that those people who are in touch with their own genuine selves, those people who really know themselves, that those are the people who should be, you know, they've thrown off the shackles really of a corrupt society, and those are the people who should be governing a society. And eventually, the entire society, an entire country, for example, should be in touch with its own genius in some way and express itself through its, whatever its political organs are, legislature. But every society has a general will. And I don't want to, you know, deal with this at great length, but it has this kind of mystic quality to it, this notion that there's a general will, that people who are in touch with their own genius represent the general will because they're no longer corrupted by all of these institutions and all of these things that have been corrupting people, and they're the ones even who should rule in this society. The implication is that perhaps even a small minority, such as, for example, in the 20th century, someone who may feel that they really represent the true dictatorship of the proletariat. Are the true will of the proletariat? Or they feel they represent the true will of the German people, you know, the purified German people. You can see how you can twist this around a bit if you put it in 20th century totalitarian thinking. 18th century was somewhat different, but it would even be a justification if Robespierre in the Revolution needed one for exercising a rule of the virtuous over those who aren't yet virtuous. You know, that those who are virtuous and who've thrown off the feudal system, who've thrown off the past, they have a right to exercise a kind of caretaker dictatorship, if you will, until everyone is purified in some way. And this is all part and parcel of the social contract. It's an interesting concept, but it leads to all sorts of strange political ideas. Well, he wrote a novel as well, La Nouvelle Heloise. It's also a novel about education. It's also a romantic novel. But it is often seen as one of the first romantic novels. I'd love to tell you the whole plot of it. You should read it. It's lovely to read. Finally, however, though, we have the genuine man, throughout the novel is always sort of in the background, who is the lover of the main figure, Julie, in the novel all the way through. Julie is torn between whether to go toward the man, the genuine man, who's kind of romantic genius, or the man who calculates and is the perfect man of the Enlightenment on the other side. She marries the perfect man of the Enlightenment, has children by him. Who does she hire as a tutor then for the children? Well, her former lover, who is the genuine man. Then the great plot thickens. And it finishes with a wonderful romantic scene where they consummate their love on a stormy lake in a rowboat or something like that. You know, that it's a perfect romantic setting for this sort of thing. Rousseau was in many ways rejecting the entire Enlightenment when he wrote this. That's why I say he's a very ambiguous figure, how to deal with him. Then we get to Emile. Emile was written and published piecemeal in about, yes?
What is the name
of the novel? La Nouvelle Heloise. Julie in English, I think it's translated as. Then you get to Emile, published, as I say, in 1762. I have the, didn't bring slides to show you, but I have the frontispieces to the first editions of Emile. Published in Amsterdam, at least allegedly published in Amsterdam. It had to have an Amsterdam, it had to have an Amsterdam mark on it. It might have even been published in France, and then not having to be smuggled in. This is due to censorship laws. It was due to censorship laws. But it was published in Amsterdam, or allegedly so. Made an enormous hit almost everywhere immediately. It was translated within a year, parts of it into English. It was in France, widely read. So it was not a little-known work from the very beginning. The book itself was seen by Rousseau as a novel. You may not, as you read it, think of it as a novel. And yet it is a story. It's the story of the upbringing of the perfect man, really, the perfect man, and that's Emile. There's a fifth book. There are four books on the development of Emile. For those of you who want to, I don't know if you've been asked to read the whole thing or not, have you? Or just the first two books? They're really the ones that were most... One, two, and five. Well, five you should read. Yeah, that's one of the great slurs on women, perhaps, even at the time. And on the other hand, there are two things I don't think which should necessarily, for some of you, you'll read book five and say, oh, you know, how can you ever take any of this seriously? Or you'll find out that Rousseau, as he tells us in his Confessions, abandoned his own children. He had children out of wedlock, you know, he had illegitimate children, and tells us they just turned him over to foundling homes, didn't feel that he could bring them up himself. This may, for some of you, say, make the book not worth reading, that someone wouldn't try and do this himself. Well, enough other people have found it worth reading. What does it tell us? What are some of the ideas that are in this work? Well, as I say, it's a novel about how to rear the new man, primarily, and the perfect wife for this new man, Sophie, but that's only a minor attachment at the end, that Emile will be reared according to nature. And nature means a couple of things in here. Nature means both the nature of Emile, his true nature, and here Rousseau is always using as a metaphor the plant. You know, that plants grow in a particular way because it's built into the seed that plants are going to grow a particular way. That from the acorn, you're going to get something that looks like an oak tree. And from each seed, you get whatever the seed is somehow has immanent within it. This notion of immanency is something that's very much a part of the Enlightenment. And human beings have this also. There's a kind of developmental sequence, a very remarkable thing at his time to even posit this. And the thing that happens, that has happened, is, as he tells us very quickly, is that we've corrupted almost everything that we've corrupted the whole notion of humankind by bringing people up wrong. That we live in a terribly corrupt age in the 18th century. He looks around him and says, well, everything is corrupted, so what do we have to do in order to get rid of this corruption? We have to take Emile away from the corruption, away from the towns. It's also one of the first anti-urban treatises here, because he really is anti-urban all the way through it. Take Emile out of the towns of France and bring him out into the country. Take his tutor. The ideal tutor would be a father, of course, he says. We don't have any mother represented very much, except when we get at the very beginning when he talks about nursing. But take Emile out into the country and raise him according to his true nature. Allow him to develop according to the way he should develop. And nature also means, of course, mother nature, if you will. The forces of nature around, which will teach Emile. It's Emile growing up here. He also uses the metaphor of the garden a good deal. He uses the metaphor of the garden and the gardener. As you read through it, you'll see this repeatedly in there. That Emile is to grow up as though he's a nicely cultivated plant. Now, this does not mean that he believes in the cult of the noble savage, as many people may have thought that he did. You know, if you ask some people, does Rousseau really make a case for the noble savage? He indeed was aware of the encounters, and the 18th century was filled with this, as with the 17th century, the encounters with people on distant islands and archipelagos, and the, you know, travelers were encountering all sorts of new people. But he wasn't talking about the noble savage. In fact, he tells us very much at the beginning that noble savages are weeds, really. He makes the equation almost with weeds. On this particular copy that you have, he says, all right, in the very beginning of it, Everything is good as it comes from the hands of the maker of the world, but degenerates once it gets into the hands of man. Now, at first that might sound like, you know, the plea to get everything out of the hands of man and go back to nature. Not content to leave anything as nature has made it, he writes, he must needs shape man himself to his notions as he does the trees in his gardens. All right? But then he says, in fact, if you let something grow just wild, it's a lot worse than cultivating it, that you have to cultivate things. So here there's the idea of the natural man, the ideal even of someone being autonomous, is not without restrictions from the very outset. In fact, we'll see that there are many restrictions. There are other forces at work. But under present conditions, human beings would be even worse than they are without fashioning. You have to be fashioned in some way. So plants are fashioned by cultivation, men by education. Plants are fashioned by cultivation, men by education. All that we lack at birth and need when grown up is given us by education. So therefore, you have to educate a human being. You have to cultivate a human being. Otherwise, all you have are the most misshapen weeds that grow along the road somewhere. And that's not what he wants at all. He wants something that's cultivated and raised properly in accordance with its own true nature and in accordance with some notion of the laws of nature. Now, who's going to interpret those laws of nature? Who's going to help raise that child? Well, here we have one of those strange figures who's very intrusive, although Rousseau doesn't seem to write him, you know, he makes you think that he isn't, and that's the tutor in this. The tutor exercises an enormous power over Emile. This tutor, if you think about him as just being, neutral and being out there just to make sure that Emile doesn't end up doing something that's going to kill him or dangerous to him, that's not his role at all. If you think about it, that tutor is up all night preparing nature to teach the right lessons, you know, so that when Emile gets up, he trips over the right stick in the morning or something else. The tutor is just not a neutral figure here. And I think you have to see the tutor as very manipulative in this. Read it with that in mind, or look back at it with that in mind if you've read it. And if you go, in fact, when you finish book five, you'll find that Rousseau didn't think he could do without the tutor. That when he and Sophie were finally going off to raise their own child, he took his own tutor along to help. He was so dependent on him. There is not entirely, the notion of nature is something that's in the nature of Emile, in, as I say, nature around one. But there's also the notion of that tutor who's doing so much to organize nature. Nature means, then, a couple of different things here. The story has a very broad purpose. It's not just, I think if you read it, you could ask yourself, is his aim just to describe the perfect education so that we have someone well-educated and brought up properly? Or is the aim here broader? Is it more universal? Is the aim of Rousseau in writing this the idea of changing society fundamentally? Or is he just writing about Emile, or is he writing about the change of society fundamentally? Is this really revolutionary? Does he have a revolutionary purpose in this? There's no doubt that he does have a revolutionary purpose. And here, again, we find Rousseau doing something that perhaps other people appreciated but hadn't articulated as yet. And that is that one of the ways by which to reform society, one of the primary ways, is to change education. Indeed, it's even important enough for a person, an important philosopher, a person who thinks he's an important philosopher, to spend a great deal of time and energy writing about education. After Rousseau, almost every philosopher gives a great deal of attention to education. Before Rousseau, you have Locke and a few. Well, Plato, of course, but there are not so many in the 18th century. They begin really around this time to deal with education and the upbringing of someone as a means by which to reform society. We think of it as so fundamental in our own society, it's become so much a part of our intellectual baggage that, you know, you never think, I think, of, if we were going to, for instance, integrate our society, we don't force adults to do it, do we? We don't force adults to move in with one another across the street necessarily from one another. We bus children around because that's the place to start. Also, it's easier. It's easier to force things on kids than trying to force adults to do that. So here we have something. Also, let me just say, for example, appeal to mothers in here. On the bottom of page 16 of your edition, he says, let mothers deign to nurse their babies, and a general reform of morals will follow as a matter of course. Let mothers deign to nurse their babies, and a general reform of morals will follow as a matter of course. What does he mean by that? Well, he's talking two things. One, he's addressing himself to this practice of wet nursing, which was so common among the upper class and even the middle class, and even later, even the tradespeople, lower middle class people of France, of putting children out to wet nurses. And this was very common at the time of Rousseau in France. But he's also talking about the fact that if only you do this, if only mothers will nurse their own children, you'll have a general reform of morals. So here, too, we have even a revolutionary implication. He goes on, the natural sentiments will reawaken. This is all if only mothers will nurse their own children in all hearts, and the population will increase. Probably so, because children were dying in the hands of wet nurses much more frequently than in the hands of their own mothers. With the home a place of happy life, the domestic tasks become the dearest occupations of the wife and the finest diversions of the husbands. Once women become good mothers, he writes, men will not be long in becoming good husbands and fathers. Whether you agree or not with some of the sentiments in there, you have to see it as having a larger universal context here. As I say, it's addressed to one particular evil which many writers attacked at the time. That is this practice of wet nursing. Became so common in Paris at this time that they had nursing bureaus set up officially by the city, municipal police actually, in order to put healthy peasant girls in touch with who had had a baby and lost it or felt they could nurse two children, in touch with people who wanted their babies nursed. And the mortality rates were terribly high, in part because of this. We know that once you sent a child out into the country to be nursed, that the likelihood of its dying was much greater in the hands of these peasants who nursed them. The care wasn't as good, apparently, even though it was in the country. We know sometimes, given the kind of carelessness that went with all of this, you didn't get the same kid back. If they were nursing two, which one didn't matter, they give you one, whichever one back. We have also a rejection of original sin out and out in here. That he said, all things as they come from nature are good. The first impulse, I can almost quote these, they're not exactly quoted, but the first impulse of nature is always good in human beings. And it's a complete rejection of the idea of original sin. And it goes quite the opposite direction and makes the notion that, in fact, children are basically born good and the first impulse of nature in everyone is good. Here we have, one of the most forceful statements, something that is to have a profound effect on romantic thinkers shortly after this, that children are basically good, they're basically innocent, and all you have to do is read the poetry of William Blake, written shortly after this, in which he writes one of his most well-known and illustrated, one of his most well-known poems, series of poems, and the illustrations that go with it, having to do with the innocence of childhood, Songs of Innocence. It becomes a major theme, in fact, of the Romantics, that children are basically little cherubs. They're not some evil creature, some little thing that crawls around and does only bad things. The children are closer to nature, for example. Blake tells us that children still have the ability, when they get down on the ground and look at little grasshoppers or things on the ground, that they're actually a part of nature yet. An adult loses that after you become part of the institutionalized world. You lose that ability to be a part of nature, which a child has just by its being a child. So we see that part of this. He also talks a good deal in these first two books about something called negative education, a marvelous concept. And that is an education which negative education really means, let me see if I can quote some of the things. When in doubt, waste time rather than save it. That's one of his maxims. When in doubt, as a tutor or teacher, waste time rather than save it. The whole notion is if you let nature work, rather than force a child to reason before it can reason, force a child to read or write before it can read or write, that in fact the child will grow up being an autonomous individual. But what we do instead is force children to learn to read, write, and reason much before they can. Rousseau, even when he talks about reading and writing with Émile, he said, if you ask me to talk about reading and writing, they're not even worth talking about in a book on education. They're not even worth talking about. And education here means the whole child rearing process of Émile. So he also talks then about this negative education. I have a couple of the quotes which I think give the flavor of that. May I set forth at this point, he writes, the most important and the most useful rule in all education. It is not to save time, but to waste it. It is not to save time, but to waste it. We tend to think, you know, every generation should learn what the last generation learned sort of one semester earlier. We have a kind of trickle-down theory that the best thing about education is to get people doing things very early, reading and writing as early as possible. His model, of course, was he didn't want anybody to read until they were 12, turns out, and then only when they really knew how to read, had a reason to know how to read. Look upon every delay as an advantage, he writes. In short, whatever instruction is necessary for them, take care not to give it to them today if it may be deferred without danger until tomorrow. When Emil asks about sex, he doesn't tell him lies, but he puts him off. He said, ask that tomorrow, or something like that. Rousseau says you should never lie to a child, but you should certainly, in some cases, put them off. The apparent facility with which children seem to learn operates greatly to their prejudice, and though we do not observe it, it is plain proof that they learn nothing. Children learn words, he says. I'll give you an example. That one can learn a catechism or one can learn a Pledge of Allegiance as a child. Justice for all. You can learn that, right? You learn the word justice. But says Rousseau that words stand in the way of one's true education. If you just know the word, you'll never know what justice is. If you live according to nature, you may learn the laws of justice as nature designed them to be learned. And then you put the word to the thing. That later on you learn the word and attach it to justice. That we learn so many words that are abstractions, and that these are words which we never really understand. We just learn the words. We learn to mouth the words. He says children do that because they learn so easily to imitate. Wait, he said, wait and let them learn, let them feel things, let them grow, let them then later put words to the things that they've learned. Well, this is, can't go into, as I say, every aspect of Emil. This is at least part of it. He also posits here a new relationship between teachers and pupils, that tutor is understanding. It's a relationship of respect, not fear. I wrote an article some time back, a year or two ago, in which I analyzed all the pictures of teachers and students up until the end of the 18th century. Invariably, in every picture that I could find, there's either violence or implied violence, almost every one. There's a stick there, there's various kinds of tools, kids having to kneel on hard peas, for example, on the floor as a punishment, this sort of thing. When you get to Emil, you have a totally new suggestion here for the relationship between teacher and student. The effect was profound of Emil. Let me just read you one exaggerated statement by a man named Edgeworth in England. If all the books in the world were destroyed, writes Edgeworth, the first I should wish to save after the Bible would be Rousseau's Emil. The more I read it, the more I admire it. It was not unusual for people to make this kind of exaggerated statement. Edgeworth even tried to bring up his own son in conjunction with the ideas of Rousseau, and it was a failure, total failure. But he blamed it on himself and not on Emil. And then he took son off to Rousseau. It was 1777, 1 year before Rousseau died. He took his son off to meet Rousseau. Rousseau marched around Paris a little with the boy and came back shaking his head. The kid, you know, just all he did was talk about how better things were in England or something like that. He was boring. We have another figure, Thomas Day. He was apparently, you know, his teeth had fallen out as a little kid and everything, not grown back. We have this English radical named Thomas Day who abandoned conventional dress, decided to live in the countryside. This was in the 1780s. Apparently, from what we can gather, he may have been afraid of women, but because he started to search for his own Sophie. And he adopted two orphan girls with the idea of, raising himself a wife. It wasn't hard to do. You went over to the orphanage and checked out a couple girls. He reared them under his supervision in Sutton Coldfield. We have the story of this. Deciding eventually that he would take the likeliest candidate, a woman named Sabrina Sidney. He would train her moral character. The hardening process is also important, but one thinks he was just a sadist in the end because he poured hot wax on her bare arms in order to harden her to heat, fired pistols close to her ears. His biographer tells us, however, that he never found that he was able to raise the proper Sophie, eventually found some other woman and married her, who was already raised. He also wrote a book called Sanford and Merton about all of this. Well, The immense importance of Rousseau, as I say, was not perhaps just because he was such a genius, but because he represented so much of what was current in his day. I think Professor Mossy next Monday will then get into all of that. Thank you.